You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Thor,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Chip Walters.
Authors, I have a fantastic new service to tell you about. It's called PubSite. PubSite is a service to help you build your very own website, your home on the web, where you can promote your work and give your fans a place to connect with you. PubSite is a website platform that allows every author, regardless of budget, to have a great-looking professional website. Developed by the book marketing professionals at FSB Associates, PubSite is the new easy-to-use DIY website builder developed specifically for books and authors. Whether you're an author of one book or 20, or a small publisher, PubSite allows you to build, design, and most importantly, update your website pain-free. No need to be dependent on a designer or webmaster to make a small but costly change to your website. Save the money and do it yourself. PubSite is the best platform for authors because it's a book-centric platform. PubSite was built just for authors and small publishers. Every design, feature, and layout is book-centric. They have customized designs for you to use. It's easy to build. No coding or HTML is necessary to create a stunning, professional-looking website with all the features you want. Get a custom domain name, yourname.com. It's simple to update. You can add all of your books, add a blog and a book tour, sell from any retailer, manage your email list and social media, and even do e-commerce. Build your website with a 14-day free trial, then pay just $19.99 per month, which includes hosting. And we offer packages starting at $499 to set up the website for you. Pub-site.com, the place to help authors find their home on the web. Before We Ever Spoke by Dan Largent. Cleveland, Ohio, 2006. After a chance encounter, three people soon find out that life can sometimes thrust us into the public eye, even when taking great measures to avoid it. Cooper Madison was the best pitcher in baseball after being drafted number one overall in 1996 from the small Gulf Coast town of Pass Christian, Mississippi. One year after announcing his sudden and shocking retirement, he finds himself seeking anonymity in Cleveland, Ohio. Kara Knox is the youngest sibling to three older brothers. After a tragic work accident to her closest relative, she has built up a tough exterior as she begins her final year of college at Cleveland State University. Jason Knox, Kara's oldest brother, is the lead detective on Cleveland's Edgewater Park killer case. After months without a suspect, he's feeling the heat from his media-hungry chief. Serendipity intervenes, and all three learn that perception and reality are paths that rarely ever intersect. Before We Ever Spoke by Dan Largent. Hey folks, you really ought to check out Patricia Gillum's Heroes of Corvus series. Book one is called A Superhero's Duty, a fight between a second-generation superhero named Red Bolt and a villain-for-hire named Icarus goes terribly wrong, resulting in the drowning deaths of three innocent civilians and orphaning a six-year-old boy. Racked with guilt, Red Bolt visits Cameron Wilson at the hospital every night and won't leave the boy's side until he falls asleep. Befriended by a night shift nurse, the man in costume begins to disclose what really happened after the fight and why he feels the death of Cameron's parents and sister fall on his actions. A superhero didn't survive that night, and Cameron and the rest of the city are not out of danger. A Superhero's Duty, Book 1 of The Heroes of Corvus by Patricia Gillum. Get this series now. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I am really excited. Pardon me, excuse me one second. Today, I'm really excited to have Chip Walter on the show with me today. He has a fantastic new book. It's called Immortality, Inc., and I know we're going to have a fascinating conversation about it. Welcome to the show, Chip.
Thank you so much.
We begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
I actually have a very clear memory of that. I was in the library when I was a freshman in high school, and I pulled a book out called The Martian Chronicles by Ray Bradbury. And I went home and started reading it that night, and it just blew my mind. And I immediately sat down and wrote my first short story. I did create a newspaper when I was 4 years old. I'm not sure if that counts. But that was really a big moment that I remember, because it just made me want to write and write stories.
I love that. Bradbury's been a gateway drug for so many people.
Yes, he's such a wonderful. Well, I mean, the other thing about him is, and I think this got in my DNA early, is he's such a wonderful writer, you know, a craftsman, but also a fascinating thinker, you know, that gets way outside the envelope. And, that's whenever I got into science writing and journalism, I thought, you know, you should be able to do this even with nonfiction. You should be able to write in a way that makes the craft, you know, accessible and interesting and compelling, not just a bunch of facts.
Exactly. You know, the ability to take nonfiction and write it with such a narrative flair that it's engrossing, engaging, and takes you on a trip just like the best fiction does. That is such an amazing gift to be able to do that.
Right, right. Big inspiration for that. And I actually have a memoriam in the book is Tom Wolfe, you know, who is the master at taking nonfiction and making it so available and so compelling in a way that fiction could be. You know, I mean, if you just look at The Right Stuff, you know, which is one of the great books that he wrote, nonfiction books that he wrote. But you absolutely feel that you're there, you know, in a story. Like a novel, you know. So those sorts of thoughts are in my mind when I began working on the book, and I really thought, whenever these events started to happen, and I was able to get to these people, I thought, this is going to be a good story, a good tale, you know.
You said that you had the desire to write true stories with the same passion that you felt when reading. Bradbury's short stories. What was it about science that made you want to write those kinds of stories?
Well, you know, we all face big, fascinating questions. Why are some things beautiful and other things seem to be ugly? Why are some people good and some people not so good? Why did we go to the moon? Well, you know, there's just so many fascinating questions. The problem is for so long in human history, we can only kind of speculate on those big questions. So we made up myths and we made up stories and, you know, come up with in the case of, living forever, there's all kinds of myths and snake oil and that sort of thing. So my whole thing when I started writing science books was, well, okay, big question. Is science, you know, can they actually solve these kinds of problems? Can they help us understand why we act the way we do, why we do the things that we do? I wrote two books just about the evolution of our behavior. Like, how did we end up becoming the strange creatures that we are? And so it was the same thing with this. You know, I just wanted to tackle a big question, but I didn't want to just ruminate on it and, you know, philosophize on it. I wanted to see if anyone was doing some serious science. Turns out they were.
When you've also been a journalist and you've worked with National Geographic, you were a bureau chief with CNN. How do you feel that your time as a journalist and maybe studying journalism or maybe the actual work in it, how do you feel like that helps you in the work that you do now?
Well, if you're a good journalist, it teaches you to be skeptical. It teaches you to be not only curious, lots of people are curious, but it teaches you to find ways to resolve your curiosity. I suppose that's one of the biggest things about a journalist is that you have a problem, whatever the problem is. It could be a murder, or it could be a car accident, it could be, you know, any number of things. It could be something like this, but you have to get to the bottom of it. You have to figure out, well, why did that happen? How did it happen? Who's behind it? And so I think I learned some of the skills in the process of writing for newspapers and then magazines and then ultimately television. And that certainly helped my book writing. I always wanted to write books, but I didn't really write books until I learned to be at least what I hope is a good journalist. You know, I certainly worked hard at it.
Right. You also co-wrote a book with Bill Shatner that I actually have on my shelf behind me where I'm recording here. And I didn't realize that you had written that with him until I was doing research for the show. And that was a great book where you guys were bridging science fiction with what is possible. I guess it was almost 2 decades ago when you guys wrote that book. What was that experience like?
It was great. It was just a hoot. We had a lot of fun. I wasn't sure what Bill Shatner would be like until I met him, and we immediately hit it off on the phone. And then we got together, and we just agreed that he said, well, you know, we have what Star Trek has done. Is there you know, some solid technology out there that might be related to it? And I said, yeah, actually, there's a lot. So we developed this idea to do a book about how the technologies that Star Trek imagined were actually coming true. And again, this is 20 years ago. It's even more true now. And so I wrote up the proposal. Simon and Schuster loved the idea. And then he and I just went, it was like a roadshow. We just went on a roadshow, and I said, okay, well, I know Star Trek well enough. It wasn't like I was a big Trekkie, but I knew Star Trek well enough to know what, you know, interesting technologies they had developed. And of course, he had a ton of history. And then I also knew enough about my own science writing to see where the scientists were out there that were developing those things or had developed those technologies. So we just kind of went on a roadshow. And he was great, you know, because he's super smart and asked a lot of great questions. So we just sort of peppered these people and then sat down and wrote the book.
Well, it's such a fun book. And that book is called I'm Working on That, A Trek from Science Fiction to Science Fact. And I highly recommend people grab a copy of it. It's so much fun, especially if you're a sci-fi fan. It's a great book to have. The new book is called Immortality, Inc., Renegade Science, Silicon Valley Billionaires, and The Quest to Live Forever. Chip, when you talked about, you know, looking for these big ideas, what was it about this idea that struck you? And what was the first inkling of this story that came to you?
Well, I think the idea that has always been rattling around in my mind, and it is one of those big, you know, questions. It's like, is there life elsewhere on Earth? Kinds of questions. So it was always out there, you know, bouncing around. And then actually, not long after, I was doing the book with Bill Shatner, I ran into a scientist. We were just having lunch, and he said to me out of nowhere that he was planning that when he died, he would be frozen. And I just kind of dropped my fork and said, really? You know, tell me more about that. And he said, well, how it works with, there's an experimental animal and a control animal if you're doing a science experiment. And I said, yeah, I get that. And he said, well, you know, obviously I'm the experimental animal in this effort, you know, if I'm going to freeze myself. And he said, but I already know what happens to all the controls. And there's just kind of this pregnant pause, and he looks at me and he goes, they all die. So, you know, so he thought, I mean, basically his argument was, well, why not give it a shot? You know, maybe it'll work. And he was a serious scientist. And, you know, when it comes to freezing your body, you know, as this company Alcor does, you know, who knows? I mean, there is science involved in it, and who knows, maybe it'll work, you know, but what I really say in the book is that that's probably not plan A, you know, that you get die and get frozen and then you have to wait who knows how long to be brought back. You know, plan A really is to not die in the first place, just keep on living a healthy life.
Right. Well, that conversation that kicked this off, that, like we said earlier, you were working on the book with Bill Shatner, that's been almost 20 years ago. This is not a new idea, even though we're starting to hear more and more about this idea, and these pursuits have been going on for quite a while, haven't they?
Yeah, because, I mean, gee, since the days of Gilgamesh, which predate the Bible, you know, we've been talking about this, you know, and there's fountains of youth and, you know, this is one story after another. So, I mean, the whole idea of religion really is a way for us to try to get around dying, the idea of heaven, you know, or nirvana or something. So it's so central in the human psyche, the idea that we're going to die, that, you know, just whenever I found that there was real serious science that was going to tackle a problem this big, I thought, well, we just have to tell this story. You have to get to the bottom of this.
Well, as you start thinking about this, Chip, and looking for where the serious pursuits of this science are going on, what leads you to Silicon Valley?
Well, it's, you know, what I was doing was I was kind of looking around at what was going on in science, and I was trying to see if there was anything really, you know, solid here beyond, you know, there's the National Institute on Aging, but they pretty much, you know, don't attempt to solve the problem of aging itself. They just try to, you know, understand why we age. You know, and there were, you know, various efforts here and there that were attempting to solve the problem, but no one really seemed to be getting much traction. And then when I came across, you know, the news that this company called Calico, which comes out of Silicon Valley and is funded largely by Google to the tune of $1.5 billion, and that Arthur D. Levinson, who happens to be the chairman of Apple, was one of the key people involved in it and was brought in to run this new company. You know, that was a big deal. One of the things you have to understand about Arthur Levinson, not many people have heard of him, but besides being the chairman of Apple, he was also the chairman and CEO of Genentech, which is the first biotechnology company. He's a highly regarded microbiologist in his own right. His 11 patents that he's written, you know, so, and then the fact that Google was behind it, the whole story that I was able to tell, which is exclusive actually, to the book, about how those people came together and why they came together and how those decisions got made, you know, make a great story. And then shortly after that, Human Longevity Inc. was founded, which is the company that's, one of its co-founders was J. Craig Venter, who was essential in the development and sequencing of the first human genome. And then there were a couple of other scientists that were involved in that, Robert Hariri, who turns out to be one of the world's leading stem cell experts. And then Ray Kurzweil, who is a futurist that you probably have heard of, and inventor. Whenever you talk to Siri or Alexa, you know, it's his technology that was really the foundation of that. And he also invented the electronic piano and optical character recognition software. So these were guys that were serious, you know, big thinkers. They influenced one another. And there was this kind of interesting convergence of money and science and social need, I think, because you have 75 million baby boomers that are beginning to feel pretty mortal. And so there, you know, there was just this convergence, and I could see it coming together. At least I thought I saw it coming together. And luckily I was able to get to these people and spend lots and lots of time with them to try to understand, why are they doing this? How are they doing it? What motivates them? And would we succeed?
Well, that's the obvious next question is, how do you, once you identify these people and the work that is being done, how do you connect with them? And were they forthcoming with wanting to share their stories and share, you know, the resources and all of this that's going on?
It depended on who you talk to. You know, I started out, I went to Ray Kurzweil. I had interviewed Ray Kurzweil multiple times over the years. In fact, he's in the book that I wrote with Bill Shatner. That's how I originally met him. And so I just stayed in touch with him. And whenever I had this idea that I wanted to get to Craig Venter and Art Levinson, I got in touch with Kurzweil and asked him. I said, you know, do you know these guys? And he said, yeah, I've got their emails. I know them. And I said, we'd be willing to open a door. And he said, yeah, I'll do that. So he did. And Craig Venter, ironically, everyone said he would be very difficult to get to, but he immediately agreed, I think partly because National Geographic was involved. And Art Levinson said, I think maybe I should talk to Chip. And Ray Kurzweil actually said, well, that's okay. I'll talk to him, Chip. You know, it'll be okay. And Art Levinson came back and said, no, I think I really got to talk to Chip. So he said, so then I get an email from the chairman of Apple that says, hey, Chip, do you have a little time to talk, maybe 5 minutes? And I'm thinking, yeah, I think I can spare some time to talk to the chairman of Apple. He called me and he just started to ask some questions. He said, look, I don't want you to think that I'm going to write some big headline or I'm going for, you know, I'm not a guy, I go in under the radar. I'm not a guy that wants to get a lot of attention, and I hate splashy headlines. So if that's what you're looking for, I'm not your man. And I said, that's not what I'm looking for. I'm just looking for the facts. I'm just trying to, you know, see what the story is. And so we had actually not a 5 minute conversation, but about a half hour conversation. And then I said at the end of the conversation, I said, so are you in? And being the very cautious man that he is, he said, nah, I'm not in yet. He said, I need to think about it a little more. And I said, I said, well, why don't I come out and we'll meet face to face and then make a decision. And he said, okay. And so I went out to meet him face to face. And by that time he had basically, bought into the idea. The one question he had for me was, if I tell you what we're doing at Calico, will you tell, you know, share that with other people before you write the book? And I said, well, why? And he said, because if you keep it under your hat until the book comes out, I'll tell you more. And I said, well, I would like to know more. So I will keep it under my hat. And I didn't really have a reason to share that with other people. I wasn't trying to pit one person against another or anything. And so he basically said, okay, then I won't talk to anybody else. So that's why everything that's in the book that has to do with that, is new information, inside information.
Yeah. One thing that really, I mean, yeah, absolutely. One thing that really struck me about the book, is the prevalence of some of these technologies that we see in everyday life now, you know, where we think about some of these big ideas a lot of times is in science fiction, and mm-hmm. you have a great history with that. But, you know, in a lot of science fiction stories, what we see are these emerging technologies that just show up fully formed on the scene one day and some mad scientist has been working on it in the background all along. And then it's this complete, sea change that just happens overnight. Mm-hmm. Well, what the reality is, right, is some of these things, we see incremental change. And one of the technologies that you talk about is the work with stem cells. And we now see, I see news stories just about every week, some athlete mm-hmm. or something who's completely blown out a shoulder or a knee that would have mm-hmm. taken major surgery and lots of rehabilitative work in the past now are doing treatments with stem cells, and we're seeing just phenomenal, healing and change going on there. I found it really interesting that we're seeing these things slowly become adopted and become part of our normal life. Do you think that's the way that we'll see this change, is slowly, incrementally, or do you think there's a big idea out there still to come?
Great question. I do think that things will be happening incrementally, in the sense that I don't expect that, you know, 5 years down the road, it's possible, but I don't think that in 5 years, someone's going to say, we solved aging. Bang. You know, here's a pill. Everybody can take it. You know, I mean, for one thing, I don't know how the hell we would handle something like that happening that quickly. So I do think that it's going to be incremental. The difference is, and we've been seeing this already over time, is that the advances are going to increase at an exponential rate. So as we gather more information, first stem cells will be the first wave that will be able to regenerate parts of the body that are breaking down. It won't be just athletes, but it'll be all of us. And so you'll be able to get your, you know, instead of a hip replacement, you just get your hip fixed. You know, the body is an amazing thing if you allow it to heal itself and give it the ability to heal itself. And basically, you will heal much more like you were 25 than instead of being 75. You know, but then I do think that as we gather more and more information, and this is in the book, you know, you gather more and more information about the human genome, and we begin to truly understand what all the gears and switches are that make the human body work, that we will begin to gain insights into accelerating ways to increase our longevity. And then I think also coming out of that will be an insights where we will truly begin to understand the things that cause aging, the underlying reasons why we age. And that might be where there's a major breakthrough. You know, if you can figure out that there are, I don't know, and I'm just making this up, five major, you know, master switches that cause us to age, cause most animals to age, then if we can flip those switches, then that will be a truly massive sea change. Hopefully by that time we'll have figured out how to deal with that.
In your research and your interviews with people and digging into the technologies, was there one technology or maybe more that just completely took you off guard?
Well, one of the things that really kind of blew me away was, I think a lot of them did, truly. I mean, the whole experience of writing the book was eye-opening, and I hope it's enlightening for people that read the book. But one of the things that really got me was the idea of animals that live unusually long and that are very similar to other animals that don't live unusually long. So one of the first ones that Art Levinson mentioned to me was Orange Ruffy. I think almost every one of us have probably eaten Orange Ruffy. You don't see it very often now, and one of the reasons you don't is, well, we almost killed them all off, but also another reason why is because they're actually very similar to another fish, perch. Perch live about 3 years. Orange Ruffy, it turns out, live 300 years. So here you see two animals that are very similar, very similar genetics, but obviously something's different about that, about Orange Ruffy. So what are the genetic switches in there that make it different? There's also an animal that we, in the course of writing the book, we discovered not only lives long, but basically doesn't age at all. It's called the naked mole rat. Ironically, the very first picture, there's a book that will be coming out from National Geographic soon called ARC, which is about every animal this guy is taking pictures of every animal that exists. And the first picture he took was of a naked mole rat. They're incredibly ugly little animals, but they just don't age. And whereas most other rodents will die after 3 years or so, these animals live 30, 35 years and they're perfectly healthy right up until the time that they die from something else besides aging. You know, something else is going to eventually get all of us, but aging is not the thing that kills them. Bowhead whales, you know, which are the second largest whales on Earth, they live 215 years. So those kinds of things. I mean, the Greenland shark lives 500 years. So why do they live 500 years when other animals aren't, you know, and what are the genetics of that? And can we somehow find out what the analogs are in the human genome that we can, you know, jigger and fix so that we stop aging?
The new book, Immortality, Inc., Renegade Science, Silicon Valley Billionaires, and the Quest to Live Forever. Chip, this is such a fascinating book and had me reevaluating the way I look at things. You know, this is a topic, like we mentioned earlier, that we all think about. Everyone is worried about the future and death and what happens and can we prolong this thing. Such an amazing work. Thank you so much for writing this book and for the great care that you took with it. If people are just learning about you, is there a place that they can connect with you online to dig into all the great work that you're doing?
Oh, well, yeah. First of all, thank you very much for those kind words. Sure, people can stay in touch with me on my website. It's chipwalter.com. You can drop me an email. You'll see a place you can drop me an email there. My Twitter handle is @chipwalter, or you can find me on Facebook. Just search Chip Walter. There's a couple of different sites there that'll bring you to the work that I'm doing, and we try to keep everyone up to date. And of course, you can stay in touch with National Geographic's website. They'll have information there as well. And then hopefully you can find the book. You know, it's out there in bookstores everywhere and online everywhere.
We're going to put a link to the book in the show notes of this episode, as well as places where people can connect with you. Chip, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
It was my pleasure. I really enjoyed it.